This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Well, pundits have compared Donald Trump's actions in the White House to the Watergate scandal for several months now. And North Carolina attorney Rufus Edmiston has a lot to say about that comparison. He played a crucial role in the Watergate investigation, deputy chief counsel to the Senate Watergate Committee, and personally served a subpoena to President Richard Nixon for the Watergate tapes. It was the first ever congressional subpoena for a sitting president. Rufus Edmiston chronicles the rest of his political career in North Carolina in his new memoir. It's called That's Rufus, a memoir of Tar Heel politics, Watergate, and public life. And he joins me now. Welcome back. Good to have you here.
Good to be with you, Frank, the most popular smart talk show host in America.
Rufus is a politician, as you can tell.
No, recovering. I'm recovering, Frank.
It's been that way ever since. I got to take you right to Watergate. And talk about the debate, the discussion, right? I mean, Sam Ervin Jr., senator from North Carolina, chair of the Senate Watergate Committee, Sam Dash, his counsel. We'll talk about your relationship with him in a minute. But and, of course, you've got Senator Baker, who is the minority, what do you call those guys? He's the big wig on the minority side, the Republican. There's got to be this discussion. We're going to subpoena the president. What was that conversation like?
Oh, it was incredible, Frank. Recall that John Dean had come before the committee. Now, mind you, this takes some time. A listener that's a little bit older than teenage. Right. But this all occurred about 45 years ago. Yeah. And John Dean had said in his statement to the committee that there was a cancer on the presidency, very famous statement. Yeah. And also he said that the president was, I'm not going to quote him, but to me he one time said the president was in Watergate up to his eyeballs. And little did we know when we subpoenaed this man named Alexander Butterfield to come before the committee in executive session, that he was going to spill the beans that, guess what, there was a taping system in the White House. And so immediately, and Gene Boyce, the lawyer here in Raleigh, yeah, had a lot to do with that because he thought of it. He's the one who really has a lot to do with the downfall of Richard Nixon. And they decided, the committee, after it was disclosed that there was a taping system, that this could make or break Richard Nixon. So the committee was in session one time, Frank, and I was in the room with them. It was an executive session in the senator's office, and they were discussing whether or not to subpoena the president. And Senator Baker said to Senator Ervin, well, Sam, maybe you ought to think about trying to call the president and see if he'll voluntarily give up the tapes without subpoenaing him. I thought that was a very novel idea then. You just didn't do something like that back in those days. And so Senator Ervin said to me right offhand, like, well, go ring up the president. Well, that's an old mountain term about go call up the president. And he said it in a manner that was like, well, can you pick up a loaf of bread while you're at the store? So I went to this anteroom and I dialed up the right number and got who I later found out was Rosemary Wood, and she said, the president will get back with you. Just hold on, Mr. Edmiston. Well, of course, I was waiting on her to come back, and this voice comes on the telephone. Senator Ervin, this is Richard Nixon. Well, remember all along he'd been saying that the committee was out to get him? Well, I was so flustered with the president coming on the phone. I said, hello, Mr. President. Senator Ervin wants to get you. I said, on the phone, sir. Oh, did I make a slip? I wrote about that in the book. Yeah. It won't come across as scary as it was. I thought I was going to have doomsday come on me, and I later told the committee what I did, and they rolled in the floor. And, of course, the president refused to turn over the tapes, and when he was talking with Senator Ervin, I could tell that it wasn't going well. And they voted unanimously. Now, see, that's the difference today, Frank. Yeah. Ervin and Baker held the glue together, and I often said I went down to deliver the subpoena in the White House in the back seat of a patrol car, and somebody said, well, was that one of the few times you were in there legitimately? And I said, now, let's don't go into that.
Yeah, right.
Let's don't go into that.
But that had to be, you're right, Senator Howard Baker, a Republican from Tennessee, the minority leader, not the minority leader in the Senate, but he was the What term am I searching for?
He was the deputy chair
on the minority side. And he was working with the committee. So to what extent was this, was this polarized over? I mean, as you say, it was a majority, a unanimous vote to subpoena the tapes. But was there a party fraction?
Of course, in anything you do, there's going to be some fraction here and there. And they accused Senator Baker, some of the more vocal people on the Democratic side thought that Senator Baker was a conduit to the White House. And my colleague, Fred Thompson, they thought he was. But there's never been a hearing that I can read about or know about where there was less acrimony because of one thing and one thing only. Ervin and Baker, from day one, said this will be a committee where we will not disagree on any procedure to take. And there was never, that I know of, any vote that wasn't unanimous on that committee. That's probably never occurred in the history of the country. And it's the only reason it worked. And it worked, of course, too, because the dynamics are quite different from today. You had people, the reason that Richard Nixon resigned, of course, wasn't the Watergate committee. It was because the Republican Party went down to see him and said, look, if you don't leave, you're going to be impeached. And if you're impeached, you will be convicted.
Right. I mean, it was simple math at that point because the Democrats had controlled both houses. But let me ask you this, though. There was a political shift taking place through the entire period. Initially, when Watergate was, you know, became public, most of the country still supported Richard Nixon. That public support began to erode.
That is when it started to erode, and you could tell by the polls, by the almost fanatical moves that Richard Nixon was making. There were some people even afraid that he might call out the armed services to protect himself. Yeah. It was getting to him, and the public perception of Richard Nixon, though, was such that they did not want a, quote, crook in the White House.
And that may have accounted for the fact that the Republicans were saying, you're a liability right now. We got to get rid of you. That is not the case today. We're going to talk about the Trump administration. I want to get your take on what's happening today and whether or not it's an apt comparison. But the fact is, you know, Donald Trump holds steady. Every damning bit of information we find out about him that is made public, when we see what he has done in public, he still has 43% of public opinion. And in some states, he's got majorities, and that's key. Which seems to
and
be why Republicans are not
to wreck a person's primary vote.
Yeah.
I've never
yeah.
seen in my short history on this earth, although I am about 70 years old, I'm not an old man like you, Frank.
you don't look a day over 69.
The hold that he has is the power to have someone run against an incumbent Republican in the primaries.
Yeah.
And that seems to be the thing that the glue is all held together. I've never seen a time when people are as afraid of a public leader. And I call it afraid. I'm trying not to be partisan about this thing. And in the book, I've tried to be nonpartisan. But the comparisons are sometimes just awesome between today and Watergate.
Let me ask you something about something you wrote in terms of the internal dynamics. You talked about Fred Thompson, who is the deputy minority counsel. He's working for Republican Senator Howard Baker, and he's your counterpart in the Watergate committee. And you say, you know, he was a good old boy from Tennessee, spoke my language. Both of us understood that our jobs had one overriding purpose, not to let anyone hurt our bosses, Senator Sam Ervin and Howard Baker. What do you mean by that?
I mean by that stakes were very high. People wanted to make their fame and their fortune off of Watergate. Daily, people were hammering on Senator Ervin's door about wanting to be hired to make a name for themselves. And we knew that somebody had to protect the flanks of our bosses. And that was simply that you don't let things get out of control. I was sort of the COO of the committee to see that the trains ran on time and got where they're supposed to be. And I viewed my job, and I think Ervin did too, as to take the burden off of him of the petty little things that can bother you and keep you from doing your job. And that's what I call protecting him.
Now, would that in any way affect the way you do your job as an investigator and an attorney?
Absolutely not. Because Ervin, he trusted people to do the right thing. Now, you can have someone with a malevolent spirit that could do some harm, But when you're around Sam Ehrman, you did not do anything that would bring discredit on him. It was just almost like one time I was in a room with him and we traveled together, and there was only one bed in there, Frank, and we had to sleep together. And I called it sleeping with God night. I didn't sleep much. I had part of my rear on the bed and part on the floor propping up, and I describe that a little bit in the book.
You do.
And Fred and I knew one another. We confided a lot. We put down little fires, little fights, and so I have nothing but high praise for Fred Thompson.
You saw this as also part of you talked about the fact that you're a recovering politician. You were always active and very interested in politics. You left the committee to run for attorney general, or left the Senate anyway, your job there, to run for attorney general in North Carolina. Talk about that decision.
Yeah. Well, I always knew I wanted to run for something, Frank. I will unabashedly admit that. And Robert Morgan was the current attorney general at the end of Watergate, and he resigned to run for the U.S. Senate. And so that left a vacancy in the attorney general's office, and Governor Holzhauser appointed a man named Jim Carson to take the spot of Attorney General Morgan until the next general election, which was that fall. And I decided that with my training, with my background in Watergate, that would be a perfect job for me. And in fact, it's the job I've enjoyed most in my life, Frank, because I could get things done. The Attorney General is a powerful office. You're beholden to no one. You don't have any particular group that you're core constituency except the people. And Bill Clinton one time was in North Carolina, and he said, just ask Rufus. He'll tell you that the best job I ever had was being Attorney General of Arkansas.
Well, no, but a lot of attorneys general, especially in North Carolina, use it as a stepping stone to run for governor. So there is a constituency.
Well, it didn't work for me that year, Frank.
No, I'm just... One of the things you did accomplish, though, was your lawsuit that was tied to the New River. Talk about that.
Oh, I grew up on the New River. The South Fork of the New River, it sustained our farm, made water for our cattle. And when Appalachian Power Company wanted to dam up the New River, that would have taken huge sections of ash, Allegheny, and Virginia. I decided that something had to be done. And it's the time I got to work with Senator Ervin almost as a peer, because he was in the Senate and I was out running for Attorney General. And I think it was a total of about 7 lawsuits I had going at one time against the Appalachian Power Company, holding them in abeyance until the Ervin and the other folks could get ready, the Congress, to approve making the New River a scenic and national river. And as that river flows by our home place today, I can think that I helped save it and in a small way, of course. But it is one of the fights that the people won over great odds, and it can show you that people can get together, because there were people that drove to Washington, Frank, in their cattle trucks and slept in them overnight so they could go lobby and testify against damming up the New River. It was a great success story. I love it.
You also have a chapter in your book called Hubris, and it talks about the time that you were investigated for your time as Secretary of State in North Carolina.
Yes, absolutely. In the book, I've not spared my own little self critiques. There came a time I almost think, Frank, that I believed that being Secretary of State was a consolation prize. I think subconsciously I thought that. And I started doing wild and reckless things, sort of abusive of time and just letting hubris get a hold of me. And it was a great awakening for me. And I went through several weeks of intensive investigation. And thank goodness Colonel Willoughby said there was no wrongdoing on the part of anybody in the Secretary of State's office, and I've learned a lesson from that. And the best thing I've learned, too, is that when you're in the valley of despair, don't stay down there and wallow around in it. Come on, get out, climb up the mountainside, and get to the top of the mountain. It was a great learning thing, and I try to tell people in the book that when you get down, if you've been a decent human being in most of your life, people will reach forth a saving hand and help you if you've not been a jerk. So my biggest advice is don't be a jerk in life, and you'll get along all right.
But I'd love to see, because it kind of comes full circle. You talked about the fact that you may have gone off the rails in terms of how you're using power. In the investigation, the audit showed misuse of public funds, misuse of public vehicle, assigning public workers to do private work and that sort of thing. And as you say, there was no reason to that you were exonerated in all of that. But what you say is, I look back and I fell under a similar aggrandizing spell captured by one of the key Watergate figures, particularly embarrassing. All of this evidence, 137, I think, elements in this audit report, no wrongdoing. It does remind us of the Mueller report.
Oh, absolutely. It reminds me, when I was doing this book, I said, you can't leave that out. It's part of your life. Mm-hmm. And it was a great learning experience, and I hearken back to it quite a bit when I think that I give people advice: don't get ahead of yourself, don't get so bloated with power and thinking that you're invisible, that you do stupid things.
So let's go back to the Trump administration now. In the 30 seconds I've given you, how do you think this one's going to turn out?
This one can't exist the way it is, because the whole separation of powers has been shot asunder. If it's like it is right now, why should the Congress exist except to appropriate and give away money? And so it can't, the Republic as we know it cannot exist under this circumstance right now.
My guest is Rufus Edmiston. He is the author of That's Rufus, a memoir of Tar Heel politics, Watergate, and a public life, former attorney general, former secretary of state in North Carolina, and, of course, counsel on the Watergate Committee under Sam Ervin. Going to be at the North Carolina Museum of History in Raleigh Thursday, May 30th. You can find out more about that event at our website, stateofthings.org, where you can sign up for our newsletter and get a daily preview. What a pleasure. Rufus, thanks so much
for
being here.
Great, Frank.
That's the State of Things for today, produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, and Jennifer Brooklyn. Robin Copley is our technical director. Al Wadarski on the board today. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.